Good morning, Your Honor. Mark Stern for the appellants. Congress mandated new cigarette warnings for the first time since 1984 in the Tobacco Control Act. Congress prescribed the content of the 9 text warnings, and the accuracy of those warnings is not in dispute. Congress also prescribed the dimensions of the warnings, 50% of the packages, 20% of advertisements. That is in dispute. And Congress also required the FDA to go through rulemaking to put together a final warning that consisted both of the text and of graphic images. And Congress was looking in particular to the experience of Canada, but also Australia, the United Kingdom, and the EU countries. And of course, that is also in dispute as a First Amendment matter. The district court, the reason that the warnings are not in dispute, and the warnings say things like smoking will kill you, it's addictive, it will harm your children. And the reason that these warnings are not in dispute is because all of these very extraordinary facts have been clearly established. 440,000 Americans die every year from smoking-related illnesses, as the Surgeon General testified to Congress, which is approximately 20% of all the deaths in the United States. Now, the district court held that both the size of the warnings and the graphic content of the warnings violate the First Amendment. And the court did that, as it indicated, it found the standard of review to be the crucial anchor of its analysis. And the court said that it was going to review the warnings under strict scrutiny. And
the court did apply strict scrutiny here. But the tobacco companies argue that they would win under any standard.
Well, sure they do.
So I'm asking you, do you think that the standard here was crucial?
I think it was crucial to the district court's holding. I don't think that the district court's analysis can sort of withstand any sort of scrutiny other than if it is a strict scrutiny, because the way the court deals with the warnings, essentially we hear nothing about what the nature of the public interest is. You wouldn't know from reading the opinion that this is the leading sort of preventable sort of cause of death in the United States, accounts for 20%. You wouldn't know that that 4/5 of all adult smokers become addicted to cigarettes before they are 18 years old.
Are you looking at the standard for First Amendment, or are you looking at the standard for the grant of the injunction?
No, I'm looking at the standard for the First Amendment, because whichever standard the court believes is applicable, it's going to involve some sort of tailoring inquiry. And obviously, when you get to strict scrutiny, it becomes a very, very hard burden for the government. And if we're looking at the Central Hudson or the Zatterer standards, we're still looking at tailoring.
Which one do you think applies here, and why do you think these graphic warnings, I assume we're not talking about the textual warning, but the graphic warning, why do you think that those would survive under Zatterer or Central Hudson?
Well, we think that they survive because when a real tailoring analysis is done, and we look on the one hand on nature of the problem and the government interest, and then say, are these warnings tailored to those problems? It's not a, it's not, you know, plaintiffs suggest, well, you need to put these on candy bars or junk food, and we have nice mock-ups, you know, of like very, you know, sort of obese people and so forth. But, you know, that really trivializes what this is about. I mean, no other, you know, candy bars and junk food are not going to put on their own websites, if you care about your health, the best thing you can do is to not start using our product. And if you care about our health, the best thing you can do is to give it up right now.
I mean, let me ask you, are you accepting the proposition that the purpose and effect of the warnings is compelled speech?
No, not in the sense that plaintiffs mean that. I mean the line of cases the plaintiffs have advocated and that the district court believed applicable are the Woolley versus Maynard, West Virginia v. Barnett, more recently the Hurley case, and, you know, as we discuss in our briefs, we think that those cases, which all deal with sort of, you know, what the court has talked about, prescribing orthodoxy in political or other religious, you know, beliefs, you know, have no application to in a warning or disclosure requirement in a commercial context. I mean, there's no case in the Supreme Court's line of cases that remotely suggests that strict scrutiny is applicable here. So no, we're absolutely not accepting the proposition that this is compelled speech within the, you know, as that term is used.
Not commercial
in the First Amendment
speech either. Why is it commercial speech?
Well, it's speech, it's in the it's part of a regulation of a business transaction. It's a warning.
Somebody sells a book, that's a business transaction. That's not commercial speech if there's a blurb on the outside of the book, is it?
Well, it would be if there was if there were a warning that for some reason.
Front page of a magazine.
Well, I mean, the front page of a magazine might have
commercial speech.
Well, no, but the process of selling it is. I mean,
this is not commercial speech has been defined by the court to be the equivalent of advertising. This is not advertising. In fact, it's just the opposite of advertising. It's not promoting a transaction. It's trying to deter a transaction. That's and so how can that possibly be commercial speech?
Your Honor, I mean, by that logic, all warnings on packages for any kinds of disclosures would be
warnings. No.
I
know the slippery slope argument, but the slippery slope applies to your argument as well. For example, how do you distinguish a situation where the government, because there are a lot of traffic accidents because people speed. So from now on the outside of the passenger door of every automobile manufactured in the United States, there has to be a graphic illustration of speed kills with a traffic accident on. What's the difference?
Well, I think that there are differences. I'm not sure.
What are they?
Well, I mean, first of all, these are point of sale warnings.
Well, cars get sold, so.
Well, I think that it's the nature of the problem. If there could be
What the difference is.
Well, I mean, if that were appropriate, if what you saw was people buying automobiles that were going to kill them when used.
Not just buying, it's using them.
Right. Look, imagine that these cigarettes could be used properly, right? I mean, the plaintiff says this isn't a real warning because, like, real warnings tell you how to use something properly and avoid the risks. So let's assume that there were two ways of using cigarettes. One of them, like, you're not going to die. The other way, you are going to die. And these are the warnings that are out there going, don't do that because that's going to kill you. And the idea.
What's that got to do with the First Amendment? That you can't use cigarettes safely. So what? What's that got to do with the First Amendment?
Well, I mean, I don't think it has a lot to do with the First Amendment in the sense that it's a classic type of warning that has been thought not to violate the First Amendment.
It doesn't have any sense, not in that sense, just in any sense.
Look, I mean, if we looked at, you know, the Supreme Court's decision in Milovitz, in which, you know, bankruptcy attorneys were required to say, you know, we are a debt relief agency, which is a term coined by Congress, you know, there was no real evidence in the record to suggest any significant problem.
I want to go back to the hypothetical I gave you, because, you know, there already are in automobiles, there are already not graphic warnings, but they're script warnings,
right,
inside, you know, and they're annoying. I mean, you pull down a visor and you've got this big yellow thing there telling you that a seat bag may explode. But anyway, what's the difference between what I suggested to you and this?
Well, case? I don't know that there would be any problem. I mean, like offhand, there have
no problem. And Congress could do that.
I mean, if there were a big sign on a sort of like where it says "Don't dismantle your seatbelts," and there were a photo of somebody being like pushed back, you know, and crushed in an accident with a big X saying "Don't dismantle," that's fine. I mean, I don't see that.
I think
a
you're
problem.
Right. I don't think there is a difference. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, if that sounded good.
I have your attention. I have a sort of a fundamental problem with the way that both sides have approached this case, and plus the district judge. And I'd just like you to comment on it. This is judicial review of final agency action. And it's therefore governed by the Administrative Procedure Act. So I look at the district court's opinion, and something is talking about summary judgment and, you know, facts that are not in material, facts not in dispute. This is judicial review of agency action, and I don't know why you haven't made this point, but the question is whether the FDA had substantial evidence to support the various factual findings that it made. This is not for a trial.
Your Honor, we couldn't agree more. We've always said that review here is on the record, and we think.
Right. I mean,
we agree. This is there's no doubt about this, and what we've urged is first that we've got two things that are being reviewed. One of them is the statute, which sets out the dimensions and the text, and the second is the way that the FDA implemented the statute. There's no argument that what FDA did was inconsistent with the statute.
The First Amendment issue is not separate from the APA. The APA says has to be in accordance with law, and law includes the Constitution.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We think that that's right. And we think that the whole thing boils down to sort of the district court says that the dimensions alone are sufficient to strike down the congressionally mandated warnings. They don't even get to the FDA at that point. We think that's wrong. The district court says all of the warnings, I mean, there's no, you know, we try to say, please look at the warnings, please look at the record, because we agree a court has to do a review. We have a voluminous record. The FDA addresses all of the concerns and arguments that are made at great length. Obviously, a court doesn't have to accept all of those explanations, but that's certainly where the analysis would begin. And there is none of that. The court says everything you looked at, you know, and everything you chose, they're all unconstitutional. It's not based on the specifics of the images. There's some that are referred to briefly, but they're all out. You just can't do it. And we think that that's dead wrong. And what we think is that when the court reviews the statute with the appropriate deference to Congress, which doesn't mean no review, but it does mean under Turner appropriate deference, and reviews what the agency did in implementing what Congress did. And there is, as I said, there is both the record examined by the agency, which sort of is really quite extraordinary, and the record that was before Congress, which reflects sort of like reams of testimony, plus judicial decisions, sort of the, you know, views of public health regulators throughout the world. You know, this didn't come out of the blue. I mean, the United States is the only, you know, country that had not adopted out of like the EU, Canada, you know, and
among those jurisdictions, America is the only one that has a First Amendment to worry about.
A point that was made by the district court, too.
And I want to go back to that a little bit, because I don't really understand where this stops. If you say that what you're doing here is consistent with Zouderer, then it seems to me that there is nothing that the government can't compel the seller of a disfavored product to put on their product if they think it's for the public good.
Right. Your Honor, could I quarrel with just the use of the word disfavored? Okay. Because I think that's a loaded term here.
Well, yeah.
A product is disfavored if, you know, sort of that connotes something different from the actual health risks. I mean, if a product is disfavored because those 9 warnings are true,
no.
I mean, if that's all that we're talking about, we're not talking about disfavored for other reasons.
I'm just saying disfavored because, yes, those things may be true. You've decided that there are all these problems with cigarettes, and your argument is, well, this is a product that you can't use without these ill effects, right? And so that makes it disfavored in your view, right?
Well, I think what it is that it is not disputed that the cigarettes cause all those problems. That's where, and then okay. The question becomes,
I will not use the word disfavored.
I understand.
Where does this stop?
Right.
In other words, if you define some problem with a legal product, some reason that you want to tell people don't do this, aren't you setting up a situation where that's true of every one of those products, and you can compel them to carry that message for you?
I think that the answer is yes. When you have risks, health risks in particular, of course you can compel them to carry a warning. The question is this warning problematic?
Okay, you can compel them to carry a warning. What Zouderer says is, it's got to be accurate. It can't be inherently misleading. It can't be something that, in the nature of things, would mislead the consumer. So you're focusing on a very specific problem. But you're saying something different here. You're saying we can require them, compel them, to essentially tell people, don't buy this product.
Your Honor, that's plaintiff's argument. That's really, we just respectfully disagree. If the result of being told, and let's think about who's buying this, right? We're not talking about free choice consumers in a non-lethal product, which is the normal sort of mode that we're talking about. And we're not suggesting that these kinds of warnings would be appropriate more generally. There's got to be tailoring. But when you're talking about an addictive product that is used in the first instance, where the whole new market comes year after year from people who aren't even supposed to buy it legally, and by the time they become adults, they are addicted, and most of those people, as the rulemaking indicates, wish they weren't smoking. 40% of the users try to stop every year, most of them unsuccessfully. So the question is, in that context, are these warnings, which, if they are, they have to be accurate, they can't be misleading, but if they're accurate, are these for some reason too burdensome, too problematic? And we think that the answer is no, they are accurate.
This is what I'm trying to understand about your argument, okay? Zouderer was looking at a situation in which there was an ongoing risk that consumers would be deceived, right? They were responding to something specific that the seller was doing, or the advertiser, or whatever. The government doesn't say here that the warnings that are on those packages are in fact inaccurate. They don't say that consumers are being deceived by what the seller of that product is saying to them. They're saying something different. They're saying people are not reacting appropriately to the risk. And so we're trying to give them a different message. Could you say, could you have 50% of the package devoted to saying, stop, if you buy this product, you are a moron?
Well, I don't think that that would be a text that the plaintiffs would concede.
They're not conceding your graphic images. I'm just trying to get at what you're saying the government can do.
That's the point, Your Honor. They are conceding. The text is not controverted. So the question is, when you add the images, does this make them into something else? And it is not a question of the government going, gee, like, you're getting it, but you're not acting appropriately. What we know is that the existing warnings since the 1990s, like Congress and the Surgeon General have known that the existing warnings are invisible. And what there's just reams of literature that explains how people don't, in meaningful ways, understand the impact of smoking on them. They have generalized notions. They don't have specific notions. Most people cannot name a disease other than lung cancer that's associated with cigarettes. Lots of, like, I think it's something like...
That's probably true of every product that's sold, that people don't, that there are people who don't have a full understanding of the dangers of chainsaws or the danger of getting up on a ladder or anything else. You know, people are not omniscient, and people don't know everything.
That's correct.
The statistics are 99% of the people who smoke know that it's going to cause lung cancer.
But what they don't...
98% know it's going to cause emphysema.
No, they do not.
I read one of the... In the rulemaking, didn't it say?
What the studies, and I'm happy to sort of provide the science, but what the studies really do show is that beyond, like, there's, like, people will say, like, lung cancer, but when they're not prompted and they're just asked, name another one. More than 50% can't name another disease. And even when they talk about lung cancer, they totally get it wrong about what getting lung cancer means, how long you're likely to live if you get it, whether it's curable or not. And
so what do these graphic images tell you about how long you're going to live after you get lung cancer? They don't tell you a thing about that.
No, the point about it is that one of plaintiffs' arguments is this: all these warnings are pointless because everybody understands everything. And my point is simply to say, no, that's not true. To go back
no,
to
I
your
don't think
honest,
that's their argument. I think their argument is these warnings are pointless because they're not going to prevent people from smoking at all.
Well, that's not. I mean, there's also evidence about that from other countries.
Yeah.
But the real question is whether warnings like this communicate the risk more effectively. And that's what the research really does sort of show. And plaintiffs have caricatured the idea of salience as being sort of a like appeal to emotion and not reason. That is absolutely not what salience is. There's a ream of scientific literature on what salience is. It's discussed at length in the rulemaking. What it is, it's not something you take apart from a cognitive reaction. Salience involves how a warning hits you entirely. If it doesn't have a cognitive, if it doesn't help cognitive processing and recall, it's worthless. And a scare tactic, as everybody in literature knows, is not only not appropriate, it would be counterproductive. So nobody wants to do that, and nobody has done it.
Can I just go back to my question here? Can you commandeer their package to say something like, smokers are idiots. Don't be an idiot. Quit now.
No, I don't think saying smokers are idiots is a phrase that's accurate. I mean, look, this only works if the warning is accurate.
Well,
if it's not, you fail at step one.
Is, basically quit now, right?
I mean, that's not a, that isn't quit to the, what this is. If you've got, what we know are that the warnings as such, the text warnings, aren't even in dispute in this case. We're only arguing, I mean, but I think that's an important point. If they were in dispute, we would have briefed up that point. But they're not in dispute. And there's a good reason that they're not in dispute.
I'm not asking you about the warnings that are actually being proposed here. I am asking a question. I'm trying to understand what the government is really arguing here. And one, you know, one response to what's going on here is to say that this isn't a warning at all. It's advocacy. And what it advocates is don't smoke. Okay? And so all I'm trying to understand from you is, could you say that? If, you know, could you have a text that said that?
I don't, without ever wanting to commit like the government in a future case, I would find that, let me sort of say, at least very problematic. But it's different from this because, I mean, we really, I know I'm sort of beating a dead horse on this, but we that there is no question and it's not disputed that these warnings, these text warnings can be put on the packages because they really tell people about real risks. So what we're talking about, and this is the only thing we're talking about, are is the size a problem and is the graphic content a problem? Those are the two things that are in dispute. And we think that the size...
So the theory, your theory is that this is... Not a violation of the First Amendment because the public's ignorant? Is that the idea?
No, it's that it's that any warning is that there's no question but that Congress can put these warnings on cigarette packages. We know that's not a First Amendment problem. I mean, there have been warnings on packages for years. Nobody's ever suggested that that's a problem. The only argument is that and the new text.
There are no cases upholding, as against the First Amendment challenge, the warnings that are on cigarette packages.
No, and they would fail immediately if they were, you know, I mean, at least I would hope they'd fail immediately. I mean, there's like warnings, you know, health warnings, sort of like, I'm not aware of any case that struck down a health warning. And the only argument here is that these warnings are too big and that they shouldn't have graphic content. Right. That's all that we're talking about. And so we don't have like a new First Amendment theory about warnings generally. We're just talking about tailoring of these.
100% of, you know, the whatever the brand is could only be on the side of the package. That would be fine with you too, right?
No, Your Honor, I mean, obviously we could sort of change, you know, the hypotheticals to make them worse, but that's not what Congress did. And
My question is...
But there is Zouderer and Central Hudson require a court to look at the tailoring and the...
What does that mean? I have no idea what that means.
Well, the tailoring is simply sort of... So if we take away any ability to sort of put a brand name on the package, then we do have plaintiff's argument that, well, that people won't even be able to tell which brand they're buying.
No, I said you put the brand name on the side.
What we have is, like, what Zouderer says is, look to see if it's crowding out, like, real speech.
Is there any study that indicates that 50% is more effective than
25%? Yes, there is. There absolutely is. There are, like, in the record, I think it's reference 28 in the final rulemaking, but there are others that I can provide. Yes, there is a lot of literature out there. This none of this stuff sort of just, you know, got picked up out of the blue, you know? Right. I mean, it's like, you know, yes, the international treaty says you could do from 30 to 50%. So, you know, like, but the international treaty, you know, puts you there with the images, and there's a lot of evidence that shows that the difference between 50 or even like greater.
Are we just dealing with cigarette packs, or I mean, the statute and the regs apply also to any form yes, of advertising, right?
And there it's 20%.
Is that challenged?
Yes, and the district court enjoined that too, even though the district court suggested that 20% might have been appropriate on a cigarette pack, sort of just said, well, but the advertisements are going to be enjoined also.
Why don't we hear from...
Yes, thank you very much, Your Honor.
We'll give you a couple of minutes in response.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court. If I could use an example to illustrate, I think, the exchange that Judge Brown and Mr. Stern were having. If you walk into a fast food restaurant, you sit down next to somebody eating a bacon double cheeseburger, and you say, that's fattening, you're telling them something factual. If you walk in day after day after day, you scream at the top of your lungs, that's fattening, while carrying a poster showing a morbidly obese person wolfing down cheeseburgers and passing out dieting brochures, you are no longer delivering just a factual message.
Would you agree, telling the person to lay off the cheeseburgers. Would you agree that the Supreme Court has instructed that we are to examine this question in context?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
In the context that this court has found is in Philip Morris. Is that not correct?
In Philip Morris, yes, Your Honor. And in Philip Morris, this court precisely said that these same First Amendment principles apply. When it remanded the corrective statements advertisement back to the court, it said they had to be purely factual and uncontroversial. And our example illustrates why this clearly crosses the line. They're no longer trying to deliver a factual message. As every warning explicitly says, the message here is to quit now.
You think the word not controversial, you think that's a legal test?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it's the Supreme Court's term, purely factual and uncontroversial.
Isn't it just an observation, not a legal test? How can you make something a legal test on the basis of whether it's controversial? Anytime there's a lawsuit, it becomes controversial, so... Right.
Well, it's a legal test that the Supreme Court has reiterated, but regardless,
I don't think in the Hurley case, it's really a legal test.
Sure, I think though that what it illustrates is a separation between I would grant you there's going to be some fuzz in the middle, but it separates what I think is on the one hand opinion-based advocacy, and on the other hand a factual disclaimer and intended to inform consumers about a product and its intended uses so that they can make an informed choice.
So here, should the district court have examined the images to determine whether or not they accurately illustrate the textual statement?
I think what the district court should have done is looked at the images, which is what it did, and determined whether as a whole they constituted...
That was not my question, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the district court should have examined each warning and determined, which is what I think it did, and determined whether the warning as a whole crosses the line between compelled advocacy and factual statements meant to inform consumers about a product and its intended uses. And
so is your position that it's the, quote, emotional impact and the horror of the pictures that is the problem, as opposed to a warning that says smoking during pregnancy could harm your child, and there's a picture of a baby with smoke?
It's part of the problem, and if I can elaborate. You start out with a simple and well-known textual message, smoking during pregnancy can harm your baby. You then effectively scream that message at people by putting it on the top half of both sides.
I don't understand.
On top of it...
Let me say, you agreed with me we have to look at context, and have not the cigarette companies advertised to make their product attractive and focused on young people who are not even eligible to buy these cigarettes?
Well, Your Honor...
So that, as the Sixth Circuit pointed out, the companies acknowledge that visual images are an effective way to communicate information.
Well, first of all, three of the parties here were not party to the RICO suit. But in any event, that doesn't change the nature of the legal test. And here the legal test separates...
Why is it relevant that they weren't parties, just so I'm clear.
Well, there were no factual findings against them, but I think the more important point is...
That wasn't my question.
The reason it's relevant...
I started off saying context is relevant. And the tobacco companies over the decades have acknowledged by their conduct that images, color, size are effective ways to communicate. And you're not challenging the written warnings, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Correct.
You're challenging only the size and the graphics?
What we're challenging is the text in the context of the overall warning. And if I could explain, again...
Let me be clear. Are you challenging the textual statements?
Not the substance of the textual statements. That's part of our challenge does relate to the size because it goes to the warning as a whole. And what our position is that when you start out with a simple textual statement, which we are not challenging, you then effectively scream that at people by putting it on the top half of both sides of the package. You then layer in an image that the government's own study shows was selected not based on its ability to inform, but based on its ability to trigger a negative emotional reaction to the underlying product. And then just to make the rubble bounce, you throw in a telephone number telling people how to quit using the product using the words, quit now. You don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out what's going on here. The government is trying to send what they describe in the context of their own multimedia advertising campaign, which is indistinguishable for all intents and purposes from this. They're trying to send a, quote, powerful message. Quit smoking now. That is a message the government is fully entitled to send using its own voice. But what it cannot do under the First Amendment is force us, the manufacturers of a lawful product, to tell people that they shouldn't purchase it.
Would you agree that it is entirely possible that the government could, on the one hand, send a message that urges people not to use a product, but on the other hand, simultaneously be informative to the public? I mean, you can do both. They're not separate messages, right?
A message can do both, and this message does have a nugget of fact in it. But when the overall message's thrust is to urge consumers to do, it goes beyond providing a factual disclaimer and urging consumers to live their lives in a certain way, as these ones quite clearly do, then you have crossed that line between providing facts about a product and its intended uses so that people can decide for themselves how to weigh those facts and urging them to undertake a certain course of action.
I have trouble discerning where that line is. I mean, you just take the one image of the fellow smoking through a hole in his throat. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's intended to convey the addictive nature of cigarette smoking. And it's also... by your lights and by that report that you cite, intended to deter people from smoking. So it has both purposes. But you say it's crossed a line. Tell me how you define the line.
The line, I think, is between, and again, there is fuzz at the border, but the line is between when the overall thrust of the message goes beyond telling people about actual facts about a product and its intended uses, and urging a behavior. So if I could look to the man smoking through a hole in his throat, what the government has done in that image is that they've selected a very rare occurrence, smacked it on the top half of both sides of the package in order to convey the notion that somehow this is common, not to tell people cigarettes are addictive, but to convey a very subjective view of the horrors of smoking. Their own study shows that adding that image to the statement cigarettes are addictive does not increase consumer knowledge that cigarettes are addictive. The only reason they selected this study was to evoke a negative emotional reaction about the underlying product. This is actually a very good example to focus on for a moment, Your Honor, because one of their other main arguments is that
it turns on the government's motive, is it?
Well, I think that motive is evidence of the overall impact of the warnings. And I think here it's quite clearly crossed the line. the reason why this is a good image to focus on is because one of the government's arguments is that when you add these graphics and they somehow improve consumer recall of the underlying message. Well, our view is that that's basically irrelevant because the thrust of the message is an advocacy one, which crosses the line. But even taking their point as stated, their own study tested whether the addition of these types of graphics actually improved your ability to recall the textual statement. And what it concluded was, on the whole, most of these things had no impact at all. For the 9 warnings, I think they tested it over 72 runs. And 62, zero impact. Of the remaining 10, 6 of them showed that by introducing the graphics, it undermined your ability to recall the textual message. And that was particularly the case for the most gruesome ones, the man with the hole in his throat, the chest staples, and the diseased mouth.
Then the argument, counsel, is if it has no effect, why are you objecting?
We're objecting because it's requiring us to put on our packaging the message that consumers shouldn't buy our package. We don't want to send that message.
You've already said that you're not contesting the textual statements. And that's why I asked you whether the district court was required to look at the graphics in the context of the textual statement to see whether the graphic did more than provide truthful information. That's your argument here about the man with the hole in his throat, that that's a very rare occurrence. You're telling me I have no idea whether that's true or not, and I didn't see anything about that in the record. But there are others where it's common. So is that the kind of analysis the district court should have done?
I think that's basically, yes, and I think it's basically the analysis that the district court did do. It looked at each warning as a whole in context, and each warning as a whole in context crosses that line between providing facts about a product and its intended uses. If I could use another example, the government cites the skull and crossbones example. Well, that is a perfect example of a symbol that conveys facts about a product and its intended uses so a consumer can make an informed choice. Rat poison is meant to kill rats. It's not meant to kill people, and if a person consumes it, it will kill them. It's useful to know that information. Now, that warning would be analogous to this one if instead of a skull and crossbones, you put on the top half of both sides of a box of rat poison a gruesome, grisly image of a dead rat underneath the telephone number 1-800-CALL-PETA in order to further a message that because we're in favor of animal rights, we don't want you to use rat poison even though it's a lawful product.
That is what these warnings do. I just want to be clear what standard you're giving the court, and I think that's perhaps what Judge Randolph was getting at, how you tell it crosses the line. In other words, if it's a sweet picture of two young children playing with each other, and then the text is underneath, you would have no problem with that?
I'd want to look at it in context and why it is that they've selected it.
The government argues that your clients have been living under the Canadian system for a decade, and you've offered no evidence to show that this has hindered your ability to market your product.
Well, in fact, in Canada, you're not allowed to display packages at retail at all. So, you know, the fact that we can't also display our packages at retail, you can't display anything at retail. I think it's kind of beside the point. Here, we have a First Amendment that allows us.
Yes, but what I'm getting at is in a more restrictive scheme, you're suggesting, exists in Canada. And yet you haven't offered any evidence here that that kind of restrictive scheme inhibits your ability to get your message across and to market your product.
With all due respect, we do have a restrictive scheme in the United States. Tobacco marketing is heavily restricted across the board. One of the few remaining areas that are left to tobacco companies is marketing on their packages. We can't do television. We can't do radio. We can't do billboards. Our ability to do outdoor advertising is very limited. Primary advertising takes place at the point of sale. The main way we do that is through our packaging. There's no secret to why they decided to take the top half of both sides of the packaging. When you walk into a store, cigarettes are displayed behind the counter. Really, the only thing you can see is the top half. The whole purpose of these warnings is to make sure that the only thing you see is the government's message, that our packages are rebranded such that the dominant message is not our message, but that the government's message, that people should quit now.
Counsel, I don't remember that argument being made, and placement on shelves, that's something that the market takes care of. I just want to be back to...
We did make that argument, Your Honor.
You did?
Yes, we did make that argument. We didn't feature it. It wasn't our critical argument. But that argument was made below, and we continue to make that argument.
All right.
Tell me, just to clarify, you say only the top half of the package is visible in the store? Why is that?
Yeah, so basically under both state and federal law, tobacco products can't be individually accessible by the consumer, him or herself.
Right.
You have to ask a clerk for it. So typically the way they're displayed is that there's some kind of display behind the cashier, behind the register. And they're in these racks where, the rack has a little shelf on it over the bottom, and then what you see is the top half. When you're standing at a distance from the cash register and in the manner it's displayed, the primary thing that you see is the top half of the packaging. The FDA actually has a very good image of this on their website. They have a before and after shot of what retail locations will look like before and after the implementation of the rule. The point of this image on their website is to show how, whereas before the rule, when you walk to the retail point of sale, you can actually see the branding. After the rule, you don't see the branding. What you see, the branding that you see is the government's anti-smoking branding. And that's really the fundamental problem here. What they've done is they've rebranded our products. That's the language that they themselves use in describing this rule. They've rebranded our products such that the dominant message is not our marketing message, but their anti-smoking message. And that's why there are sort of two fundamental flaws in this rule. The first, which is what I was emphasizing at the beginning of the argument, is that we believe it requires us to disseminate a substantive anti-smoking message. As every package says, quit now. Quit smoking now. The other thing it does is it takes one of the few remaining areas left that we have to market our products, rebrands our product so that the dominant message is no longer our marketing message, but theirs. The graphics overwhelm our message, so all that consumers see is the government's message. And that's really the overall overall thrust and purpose of this, as they acknowledge.
What's smoking now, is that like one of the nine things that can be put, or is that something separate?
That's on every single one of these warnings. Right. So they require it on every single one of the warnings. Quit
now. Suppose
they
were struck.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Suppose that was struck.
Well, we still think that it would be unconstitutional. If I could go back to the hypothetical that I opened up with. If you walk in and scream at the top of your lungs, that's fattening while carrying gruesome pictures of an obese person wolfing down cheeseburgers, I still think that what you're sending is an advocacy message, particularly on this record that shows that the FDA actually compared. They did an 18,000-person consumer study, the largest consumer study ever to analyze the efficacy of graphic warnings. The FDA specifically compared every one of these warnings to a warning that simply put the new text on the side of the package in its current location. And what the FDA's own study concluded is that relative to putting that text on the side of the package, these graphic shocking warnings do not improve consumer knowledge one iota of the risks that the warnings address. The FDA's own study also concluded that it didn't impact consumer behavior over tobacco products. Their cost-benefit analysis concludes that the benefits of this, and this is their language,
the rulemaking or the preamble, did the FDA at any point say that these graphic warnings will result in people smoking less?
Yes, in the rule where they describe the regulatory impact analysis, they say that we expect this to result in a reduction of smoking of the number was 0.088%, less than 0.1% of the smoking rate. When you actually read through the entire report, I think it's around page 399 of a 400-page report, that's where you sort of get to the punchline. They concede that's a statistically insignificant number.
Also rely upon the experience in Canada. There was a decrease in smoking in Canada.
And in fact, that's what the regulatory impact analysis relied on. Yeah. It compared the smoking rates in Canada to the smoking rates in the U.S. It assumed that whatever Canada experienced would translate into the U.S., and their cost-benefit analysis concluded that the likely benefit was not statistically significant, statistically indistinguishable from zero. That's the 0.088% number. So they rely on a bunch of other studies that don't actually address this issue. They conducted two studies specifically in connection with this rulemaking that address the very issues, the 18,000-person consumer study and the cost-benefit analysis. The consumer study shows that relative to text, the warnings do nothing to increase consumer knowledge of the risks that the warnings address. The FDA study likewise said no likely impact on consumer behavior. At the same time, the regulatory impact analysis concluded, based on a comparison to Canada, that the likely benefits of introducing the warnings here were statistically indistinguishable from zero. That's the 0.088% number. Now, they do cite a bunch of studies that purport to find information deficits, but they're all on information deficits that these warnings don't address. There's not a single study that shows that there's an information deficit on, for example, cigarettes cause cancer. What they do is identify that there are certain statistical deficits on certain statistical risks that these warnings don't address, such as the average number of years of life expectancy lost from a lifetime of smoking. Well, the warnings don't provide that missing information either. And on the things that they do address, the consumers are universally aware in this country, which is why, to bring it all back to the beginning, which is why when the FDA selected these particular graphics, they did not select them based on the ability to inform. The sole factor that they relied on was whether on their FDA study, each one of these graphics triggered a negative emotional reaction about the underlying product. That's precisely what the salience term does.
The premise of this entire thing can be stated quite simply. It's that if people only knew the risks, they wouldn't smoke. Is there any evidence of that?
No, there's no evidence of that, but there's also, I think that this is even worse, though, because this is not about people understanding the risks. This is about trying to create an association between a product and just negative emotions. If I could just give you one small blurb from one of the studies that they rely on, one of their key studies, on why they use these kinds of shocking graphics. This is from Dr. Kempf examining the effectiveness of proposed cigarette package warning labels, one of their studies. Quote, the general purpose of most fear appeals is to generate unpleasant tension and arousal, which can be relieved by following the recommendations specified in the message. In the current context, the behavior recommended, either explicitly or implicitly, is to quit smoking or never to start. That is precisely what they're trying to do with these warnings. They're trying to make consumers associate a lawful product with a feeling of revulsion and disgust as part of an overall message to tell consumers to quit now. Again, you start out with a simple, universally known message. You then scream it at people with graphics selected precisely based on their ability to trigger a negative emotional response. And in case they don't already get the message, you throw in a telephone number telling how to quit using the underlying product, using the words, quit now.
Your assumption is that the only basis for compelled disclosure in the commercial context is to inform or to make something not misleading, not to deter use of the product, which is what you just said. What case stands for that proposition?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that there are lots of cases I can cite.
There's no case one way or the other. We're in new territory. Because if one accepts your argument, you accept the proposition that the First Amendment does not allow the government to require disclosures for the purpose of deterring use of a particular product.
And I believe that the government effectively conceded that when it conceded to Judge Brown that you couldn't actually put on the tobacco product, don't use this product. I think they would concede you can't do that. So they concede the point that the government can't use a warning in order to tell people not to use a product. The only question, then, is whether that's what this warning does. And in our view, when you look at the warning as a whole, in context, that is precisely what this warning does. When you scream a well-known message with graphics selected solely based on their ability to trigger a negative emotional response, even though their own study shows it doesn't increase knowledge, and then you throw in a telephone number telling people how to quit using the underlying product, using the phrase, quit now. I think there will be hard cases under the Supreme Court's case law. With all due respect, I do not think this is one of them, because I think by any objective measure, any reasonable person looks at these graphics, and as all of the media reports that came out in the wake of these things made clear, they effectively grab people by the lapels and shout, stop smoking.
Well, the closest case that I can think of is Posadas, Justice Rehnquist's opinion in the Puerto Rican gambling case. If you can ban it altogether, you can do something less, which is a you know, the Supreme Court recognized later as a totally invalid argument.
But, yeah, I think that's right. Posadas is essentially dead letter. I think a better case is actually Pacific Gas and Electric. Yeah. That was a case where they required the utility company to carry in its empty space, the empty space in its envelopes, the third-party policies of another entity. And the Supreme Court made crystal clear that under Zouderer, you cannot compel a commercial entity to carry a message that is either that either it disagrees with or is biased against it. I think that under no objective measure could you conclude that these are not biased against our products when they deliberately select images not based on their ability to inform, but they're based on their ability to evoke a negative emotional reaction against the underlying product.
But the record is that that is how people are informed, and you can't get away from that part of
it. But, Your Honor, they don't cite a single study that that's how people are informed. All of their studies
talk about the emotional impact and how people understand information. And that's bolstered further by the fact that the current warnings are invisible.
No, Your Honor, the record doesn't support that. They do not cite a single study that shows that by introducing this graphic or graphics like these, it increases consumer knowledge of the risks. All of their studies on salience simply show that they trigger a negative reaction. And it's because these warnings were never intended to promote informed choice. The Institute of Medicine report candidly acknowledges that. It says the purpose of graphic warnings is not to promote informed choice. That is virtually a verbatim quote. So all of these studies they cite are not aimed at trying to figure out whether the warnings promote informed choice. They're aimed at trying to figure out whether introducing these graphics constitutes effective anti-smoking advocacy. And the point is that when you put on a shocking image, you trigger a negative emotional reaction, which in turn constitutes effective advocacy. Now, I may disagree with that conclusion, but it's really beside the point because it confirms beyond all doubt that that's the purpose of these warnings, to engage in effective anti-smoking advocacy, which the government is perfectly entitled to do using its own voice, but cannot force us to do. And at the end of the day, Judge Brown, this goes to one of your earlier questions, it doesn't really matter whether you apply Central Hudson or whether you apply strict scrutiny. Because the Supreme Court has made quite clear that even when it comes to commercial speech, and this is the Sorrell case, the government may not burden the speech of others in order to tilt the public debate in a preferred direction. And that is precisely what this rule does. It imposes massive burdens on us in order to tilt the public debate in its preferred direction.
Can I ask you one thing?
Yes, Your
you
Honor.
Do not object to the text warnings. In other words, those are conceded to be accurate.
Correct.
If they simply required you to put that textual warning at the top of your package in 18-point type, would the tobacco company still object to that?
Yes, Your Honor, we would, and that's sort of what we were objecting to in the Sixth Circuit case. In that context, I still think that you'd be shouting a well-known message, much as walking into McDonald's and shouting at the top of your lungs, "This makes you fat." On the other hand, I also think that it's clearly unjustified and unduly burdensome, which is the final point I wanted to get into here. Here we actually have a factual record on this case. The government, again, conducted a specific study that did essentially the test that you're suggesting. They compared putting the new text on the side of the package specifically to these new warnings on the top half of both sides. They likewise did a cost-benefit analysis. Their own study shows that relative to the text-only control, the text on the side of the package, no increase on consumer knowledge of the risks that the warnings address, no change in smoking behavior, no increase in the ability to improve recall of the underlying textual message. It did show that you could recall the shocking graphic better. Yeah, I can remember what picture I saw, but it showed no improvement in the ability to recall the message. And the regulatory impact analysis shows that the expected reduction in smoking is 0.088%.
Do you agree, I asked this question of Mr. Stern, that because this is judicial review of agency action, the question, whatever factual statements are contained in the preamble to the rule, we're bound by them if there's substantial evidence to support them, that we're not in a trial situation. You're familiar with Camp v. Pitts, the
sure.
Supreme Court case that says, you know, you take the record developed in the administrative agency, and if there's any ambiguity, you remand it. What you don't do is have a trial in the district court. And the district court here treated this like it was going to go to trial. It's summary judgment.
Your Honor, I mean, I think that we had an APA claim and we had a First Amendment claim. I think the First Amendment claim is separate.
I can't see that. I mean, this is judicial review of agency action. You're trying to have regulations set aside. Mm-hmm. If your argument is they're inconsistent with the statute, that's one thing. If your argument is they're inconsistent with the Constitution, that's another. But it's still...
Sure.
Governed by the Administrative Procedure Act.
Let me give you an example. In Lorillard, the Supreme Court struck down the 1,000-foot rule, no advertising within 1,000 feet of a school or playground. I don't think that the agency can somehow lever itself into getting more deference than it otherwise would get by laundering the exact same rule through a regulation. So here, I don't think you can change the standard. But regardless, even if you look at the record here, I think the deference doesn't mean judicial abdication, particularly in the First Amendment context.
I'm talking about the substantial evidence rule. If there's substantial evidence in the record to support the agency's finding, then we're bound to accept it. And what we don't do is send it back for a trial.
And
because
that
it can't be Pitts. Yeah.
And possibly if we were debating the accuracy of cigarettes are addictive, smoking can kill you, and whatnot, that might be relevant. That's not what's been joined here. We're not disagreeing with those simple factual statements. We're disagreeing with the thrust of the message, which is an advocacy message. But I do disagree that you can somehow leverage yourself into greater deference because you've laundered a law through a regulation. I'll also add, that's not an argument that they've made. They've argued that they're entitled to deference under Turner, not because you owe deference to the agency, but because you owe deference to Congress. Here, the problem is that, one, the Supreme Court held in the Brown case, or suggested in the Brown case last term, that kind of deference...
Which Turner, one or two?
Excuse me? Oh, I think that Turner 2 is what they're relying on. What the Supreme Court held in the Brown case is that kind of deference only applies to content-neutral laws, not content-based laws. But the more fundamental point is here, Congress actually didn't make any findings about the graphic warnings. They were added on the day before the act was passed. So if you look at Section 2 of the act, which lays out about 50 legislative findings on all manner of issues, including various provisions and why in Congress's view they're constitutional, there is not a single legislative finding about the graphic warnings because they weren't considered. They were simply added at the last minute. Regardless, though, Your Honor, of whether you apply deference or not, we think that their record clearly establishes, one, it doesn't change the nature of the message.
The factual basis for the rule is quite important because there's a line of Supreme Court cases, Edenfeld Field versus Fain and so on and so forth, which are commercial speech cases, the CPA case, where the Supreme Court says that whatever the state's asserted interest is has to be supported by facts, by evidence. So the factual basis for this, and basically your argument is basically that the evidence in the record doesn't support the interest that the government asserts here.
Well, if I could respond, two responses. First, our first argument, the record is irrelevant. Our view is that the nature of this message is compelled advocacy, and there's not a record that could justify that kind of
message. You say this is not commercial speech?
Right. It's certainly not commercial speech. They are requiring us to disseminate an advocacy message. You should, even though tobacco products are lawful, consumers should exercise a personal choice not to use those products. That message, I don't care what kind of record they could possibly justify, they can't justify forcing us to send that message. That is verboten under the First Amendment, no matter what the facts are. So let's put that aside, though. We think that's the right way to go here, and that's the way the district court did go here, in which case I think it was entirely correct to say that the record was irrelevant. Let's put that to aside and then look at the factual record here. I still think that this is a First Amendment case where they have the burden of proof. And we do have a record where they conducted two studies precisely of this very rule. You don't have to look very far to understand what the effects of this rule are under the administrative record that they themselves cite. And their own record establishes that it has no impact on knowledge of risk, no impact on behavior, but rather the only impact it had was on its ability to trigger a negative emotional reaction to the underlying product. So, frankly, I don't think it matters which way you go. This thing is clearly unconstitutional. I think the district court had the better part of it by saying that because it's so clearly across the line into advocacy, I don't need to get into all of these other things. But if you do get into all these other things, it's just as unconstitutional.
All right, thank you. Counsel for appellant?
Mr. Brown, I'll try to just briefly respond to a couple of points that my friend made. And obviously, the record will have to speak for itself and the court will view it. I just point out that the studies which Mr. Francisco cites were not conducted for the purposes for which he suggests they were conducted for, and they do not say what he suggests they said. In particular, the study of the 18,000 consumers, what the FDA is saying is we tested these for salience. We were not doing a longitudinal study, and we're also, they were not trying.
What does salience mean?
Excuse me, Ryan?
What does salience mean?
Oh, salience is, and it's a term that's discussed at length in the rulemaking, but salience is essentially sort of I think it's generally defined as the prominence and sort of a message from among other information at a given point in time.
Sort of the disgust factor.
No, it's absolutely not the disgust factor. It is, I mean, this is very clear. I mean, what it is, it's not a concept that the FDA comes up with. It's a concept that goes, how, when you see a combined text and image, and like these images, all we're talking, as the FDA repeatedly says, we're talking about the interaction of the text and the image. The image.
Is there any study, put Canada aside, indicating that because of these particular graphic images that smoking will decrease?
No, what the
you say no?
There are suggestions, but I'll tell you what the problem is in trying to do this. And this is what the RIA, the regulatory impact statement, which is essentially a shoestring operation, didn't have a lot sort of, you know, and that speaks for itself too. But the problem that gets confronted is, yes, there was a big decline in Canadian smoking rates after the current warnings or the warnings
that's a correlation causation.
No, that's right, Your Honor. And what's very hard to define is the precise correlation statistically in the number of people who stop smoking, particularly over any particular time, because of which of the several measures that are being taken. But there's lots of evidence from the Canadian study, from Australia, from Great Britain, from focus groups in the United States that shows that those kinds of warnings lead to people thinking and talking about the warnings and comprehending it. It is not, as the FDA repeatedly says, and they respond to this repeatedly in the rulemaking to those comments made by the tobacco industry. Because, no, you've got to look, salience is the combination of cognitive and emotional, and it is a predictor of how you're going to process and recall this in the future. And as they say, the fact that, you know, one, they were not particularly interested, they looked to see where people were a week later, that wasn't what they were concerned about. They were concerned about where you're going to be after you see these things repeatedly, thousands of times a year, long after any initial sort of quote shock has worn off. How is this going to be processed by people when they're making decisions about whether to buy? And that's the key point. Relatedly, the statement that this is the packaging is the last best marketing opportunity is simply inaccurate. There are display ads around stores. There are magazines which plaintiffs they've got the Sixth Circuit to agree that they could do this in
this
color.
Could rise to a new market, cigarette holders. Just empty the pack and throw them into a cigarette hole.
It could do that. That was, after all, the way that people used to do it anyhow. The point, though, is it's not a sort of this. All that it is, it's a way of getting across a warning. The warning has to be accurate. These warnings were not chosen to disgust. They explain why, you're looking skeptically, but the point about, say, the tracheotomy hole. Now,
Is that in fact?
Well, people, I've seen people do this, and like what the record shows is that 50% of people with neck and head cancer continue to smoke. They don't necessarily all have a tracheostomy hole, but that is the point about addiction, that when you talk about hamburgers and gummy bears, like there's a lot of like, whoa, it's addictive. No, addiction really means addiction. It means that. And this is where, like, adolescents in particular notoriously overestimate their ability to withstand nicotine addiction. And what this is saying is, no, this is real addiction. These are guys who, like, at the point where it's killing you, cannot stop. And that is a real thing. This is not disputed. So that's the fact that particular phenomenon of using it in the hole isn't what happens to most people. Of course it's not. But does it accurately and meaningfully depict the message that this is really addictive, not just sort of like addictive and like maybe a little hard to be a habit? Yes, it does. And that's exactly the point that needs to be gotten across. You know, because this is an addictive product, it will kill you, and there is nothing in the First Amendment to suggest that, yes, the product's lawful, the fact that you could ban it doesn't mean that you could do anything you wanted to.
These arguments are fine, but the government can get that message out. The government can put a billboard up.
Of course it can, Your Honor, and it does.
TV shows or TV advertising.
Your Honor, the government... Like,
the question is whether you can use the company's product to foster the government's message.
Well, if the government, if put in terms of a message as opposed to a accurate warning, that's a different question. When can the government say that a seller has to put accurate warnings on when their products can kill people and just make them say that? Sure. You know, and no, Mr. Francisco's argument is entirely that, well, just the size alone, like, transforms this into, like, a message that weighs a policy debate. There's no policy debate that's going on. And there's no, it's not a preferred message. It's going, look, this really is going to have these effects. And you can, like, you know, it's legal. You can go ahead and buy it. You know, we're going to have other ads that are going to try to persuade you not to. But no, when you buy it, you know, that this is really what's going to happen. You know, and the idea that that contravenes the First Amendment, you know, that's just, there's nothing there. Woolley versus Maynard, you know, Pacific Gas, none of those cases involve that. And what you usually have are the cases that are, which rely, like Sorrell, are all restrictions on speech.
Is this just for individual packs?
Yes. I don't know about the carton.
Cigarettes are sometimes sold in cartons.
Yeah.
Does it apply to cartons?
It applies to the cartons also.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Sure.
We will take the case under advisement.
Thank you very much.